But as we begin our program, I want to welcome to our show Mark Ames. He's a founding editor of the satirical Moscow biweekly newspaper or magazine, The Exile. He's author of Going Postal, Rage, Murder, and Rebellion, From Reagan's Workplaces to Clinton's Columbine, and co-author of The Exile, Sex, Drugs, and Libel in the New Russia. Mark, appreciate you being here tonight. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
First of all, your story is fascinating, and I think our listeners will appreciate your perspective on some of the issues we're going to be delving into about Russia, to know a little bit more about your project with The Exile in Russia and the eventual closing down of that publication, and your ties to Russia at this point. It would be good to hear that. Can you fill us in a bit?
Yeah, well, so I started this newspaper, pretty radical, satirical, investigative journalism newspaper in Moscow, in sort of the peak Yeltsin years in the mid-late 90s. And my partner in it was Matt Taibbi, who's with Rolling Stone now. And, this was at a time when Russia was the sort of the American IMF colonial project number one, 1.111. And it ended in complete, utter disaster, and the rise with, and then followed that by the rise of Putin. I mean, Yeltsin years were among the most disastrous in Russian history. And that was followed by Putin and then, all the problems we have today. The newspaper somehow survived on the margins, through the first Putin era, but eventually they caught up with us. And in 2008, they charged me and the newspaper with various charges that could include, prison time, editorial extremism, and so on. And they sent four Kremlin officials to our editorial office and shut us down. And eventually, I had to flee the country. I was accused by one of Putin's sort of the head of the Putin youth group, who was then in the Duma, of being an extremist, which is kind of like being called a terrorist, in part because I opposed the Iraq war. This guy said every citizen's duty is to support their president in every war. But in any event, so I had to flee the country, and the paper was shut down, and it was all pretty unusual and frightening. This was back in 2008. So I came back home, and I've been working here, since then, and I've kind of been drawn back to an interest in Russia and writing increasingly about Russia again in the last, 2 years, I'd say, in part because Russia's really pushed its way to the top of the agenda here, and certainly in this campaign, I mean, the anti-Russian xenophobia and the Putin, I don't know, it's like a mania about Putin behind every single illness in this country. It's bizarre. We've kind of entered bizarre land, I think. So I'm not a huge fan of, of Putin and the Kremlin for obvious reasons. But what's being put out now about how Russia is subverting and destroying everything this country holds dear is insanity on a level I haven't seen like since the Reagan years.
And you have some familial ties with Russia, given that your wife, I've read, is Russian, right?
Yeah, my wife is Russian, so I take it kind of personally when the media starts putting out this concerted effort portraying all Russians as criminals and enemies. I don't want my son to grow up with that stigma attached to him. I mean, and especially when it's all based on propaganda and BS. I take it personally, and I keep a foothold there, and I have plenty of friends out there, wife, family. I still speak it. We speak Russian at home. So I look at Russia as with my experience there, Russia giveth and taketh away a bit. It was where I built, learned journalism and learned a lot about the world, because Russia is a lot more, everything there, politics and society, was a lot more raw than here. Mm-hmm. But you do see similar structures and similar scams and schemes, you know, in both places. So Russia really helped me see through a lot of the fluff and BS here in America.
How many years?
But eventually Russia tossed me out.
So, yeah. How many years total did you live in Russia?
So I was there on and off for 14 years, I think.
Oh, yeah. Quite a time. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And I haven't been back since 2008.
I guess you would not be an honored guest at this point. No.
I'll go back sometime. I don't think, I doubt they'd care or remember, you know. Mm-hmm. If they do, they just turn me away at the border. I'm not that worried, now, but yeah, that's how it is.
Right. Well, Mark, I wonder if you'd share with us, and you gave us a bit of a glimpse of it already, but I wonder if you'd share with our listeners your overview of what's happening now in regard to the accusations leveled at Russia that Moscow has been hacking DNC and Hillary Clinton's campaign emails and is blatantly interfering and attempting to manipulate the outcome of our U.S. election in November.
Well, I look at it two ways. I'm willing to believe it and accept it if I see evidence, and I haven't seen evidence so far, and that fact, and the fact that we're in a, you know, very, very heated political campaign season, that really bothers me. And I'm not going to just give our intelligence services or the unnamed intelligence officials, you know, the huge benefit of the doubt on something so serious. We're ramping up a very serious and potentially dangerous Cold War over these accusations. So I want actual evidence. So far, the evidence I've seen that everyone was waving around was apparently in the metadata on some of these hacks. Somebody called himself in Cyrillic letters, that is in the Russian alphabet. So it went by the name Felix Edmundovich, which is the name and patronym of Felix Dzerzhinsky, the founder of the Cheka, which became the KGB. Now, that being used as evidence that was actually a GRU, a Russian military intelligence agent, because he used as his nickname the founder of the Cheka, is to me so absurd. It would be like an American spy mole, you know, mulling his way into North Korea and using as the super secret name Alan Dulles or something. You know, I mean, it's
Alan Dulles being the founder of the CIA, right?
Yeah, or one of the early directors and co-founders. Yeah, I mean, it's just. You have to know nothing about Russia to think that is a plausible piece of evidence. I have a lot of questions, too. I mean, according to the timelines, according to these stories in various major newspapers, the FBI first noticed the hacks in June of 2015 and first told the DNC 2 months later. So now, if the Russians are trying to make sure that Hillary Clinton doesn't win, if this is not a Clinton campaign strategy to deflect from what's actually in the emails and try and make it seem like you're a traitor if you report them, if the Russians were actually trying to keep her out and they started hacking 6 months, 7 months before the first caucuses, why didn't they do a single thing to help Bernie Sanders ever? Why did they do anything up through, you know, April when it was still a contested primary, even up to early May, to help Bernie Sanders? This is a guy who spent his honeymoon in Soviet Russia in a banya with Soviet local officials in Yaroslavl. This is a guy who's, you know, sympathetic to the Sandinistas, sympathetic to the to Fidel Castro. Obviously, this is the guy you'd want to help. Why would you wait till Donald Trump, this crazy buffoon? You know, she runs against him, the only person she can probably beat on the Republican side. So none of this just makes any sense to me. Unless you think the Russians are both incredibly evil and manipulative and deceptive and powerful, but at the same time, incredibly stupid and inept, and they go by, you know, agent code name Alan Dulles of the CIA. I mean, so I just I could go on and on, but these are just some of the more obvious things. This does not seem to me, again, it's possible, and I keep waiting for the evidence. And thus far, the only piece of evidence, hard evidence, that we have now is that the administration finally came out, I guess it was a week or two ago, and said, yeah, we're now going to name them. So it took them a year and a half to name Russia as the ones behind this. Now, I remember also, so there's the issue of the hack, and then there's the issue of what they're trying to do. And what's being said is Russia is using disinformatia, active measures, disinformation to try to destroy Americans' trust and faith in our institutions and in our democracy and so on. And this is all a rehash of the same BS that was fully debunked in just around when Reagan came to power. I don't know if you remember this book, The Spike. It was a huge deal. I remember it as a kid. As a little kid, I was kind of fooled by it. I was 13 years old, by Robert Moss and Arnold de Borsgrave, and it was a very powerful influence. Reagan said it had a big influence on him. It was a book that posited that basically all of the critical investigative stories of the 1970s in America and the Church Committee and all of these things were actually part of a Soviet disinformation campaign, a Russian disinformation campaign, to weaken Americans' trust and faith in our institutions in order to paralyze us. Now, the whole thing was completely debunked. First of all, it was a novel. Secondly, even it was taken seriously, but it was completely debunked. And it was exposed as a pure propaganda ploy put out by former CIA and MI6 people and right-wing Republicans. And I just see the same thing being repeated now, except that it's being... This time the water's being carried by liberals, by Clinton supporters, by the New York Times, which the last time around, the Reagan era, was supposed to be a disseminator of Soviet disinformation. They were supposed to be the Soviet dupes in the Reagan era version of this. Now they're the ones calling others dupes if you repeat what's in the emails. So I don't know. Now, that's one thing. The other thing I would say is this. We have been deeply involved in manipulating Russian elections and Russia's political system. We're less so now, the longer that Putin's been in power, much less so. But certainly, in 1996, we had actual American advisors who took credit for stealing the election for Boris Yeltsin, who went into the election in 96, most unpopular person in all of Russia at a 3% rating. Among the many things these guys did is they told Yeltsin to consolidate all of the media under the government, which he did, and to lie and to turn the media into a giant propaganda tool to scare everyone that if they voted for his communist opponent, Gennady Zyuganov, that they would all be in death camps. And that's what they did. They scared everyone. There's a movie about this with Jeff Goldblum. I mean, we never hid this fact. And behind that were tens of billions of dollars from the IMF, from the World Bank, all pushed through the Clinton Treasury Department. And then as recently as 2011, what brought all these Russians out into the streets, and it was a huge protest. And I don't mean to take away the genuine grievance, because there were real grievances over that election. There was real fraud, very similar fraud to the fraudulent elections in 1996 that we blessed as free and fair, that we oversaw, that we helped cover up. But nevertheless, fraud is fraud, and it's infuriating for anybody to go through that. And so in the 2011 elections that essentially brought Putin back from prime minister back to being president again, tens of thousands of Muscovites took to the streets. They were very angry. But one of the main things that brought them out to the streets is a U.S. government-funded NGO, Russian NGO called Golos, which tracked all the voter fraud. Now, again, I'm not saying – I mean, I have friends in Moscow. I understood my own wife was upset by the vote fraud and by the way that Putin kind of crudely took power again. So I want to separate those two. In that instance, America happened to be, for its own self-interested reasons, happened to be funding something that, I think as a journalist was right. If our government wasn't funding, it's a good thing, I think, to know the fraud's going on. But from the point of view of Putin, certainly, and the Kremlin, this was absolutely meddling. If you have tens of thousands of people out in the streets protesting because of something a U.S. government-funded NGO was exposing and riling people up. You know, and it's not like we do that everywhere. We don't fund these NGOs in Saudi Arabia to bring tens of thousands of people out in the streets. We do quite the opposite. So, you know, they certainly have the grievances. And Putin knew from the inside, being a spy, being a pretty big political player sort of behind the scenes already in 1996, he knew how we helped them steal the 1996 elections for Yeltsin. Yeltsin then is the guy who turned around and made Putin his successor. So he's very cynical and he knows the game. So he certainly would have motive for doing doing something like that. So I'm not saying it's not possible that the Russians are involved, but I'm still waiting for actual evidence and I've still not seen it.
Well, Mark, we only have a few minutes left, but I did want to ask you about, I appreciate the detail there because, the history of U.S. interference, not only in Russia, but the near abroad, as they say in Russia, in Eastern Europe, the color revolutions funded by the National Endowment for Democracy. There's a lot of history we could go over, but, time allowing, we'll try it another time. I wonder what's your view of the concern, by a growing number of people here in the United States that there's a new serious Cold War brewing between the United States and Russia, given the charges and countercharges about interference in the U.S. election by Moscow, given the history of tensions with Moscow over the annexation of Crimea and the border war in Ukraine. And then, of course, you've got the failed diplomacy to find a ceasefire, to reach a ceasefire in Syria, or to end that horrible war. What are your concerns about a new Cold War?
Oh, I think it's potentially very serious. I mean, I get that part of this heating up of this sort of new Cold War thing on the Clinton side and Clinton supporters is to, you know, it's campaigns and politics are a rough business, and I get that. But I also think it's a genuine window into what to expect in the future. I'm assuming Hillary Clinton's going to win, and I'm assuming that this is not going to be the end of this. I'm assuming that this is going to be what we have to look forward to for the next 8 years, and very, very tense relations with the Russians, and you know, I find it extremely dangerous. I find it extremely dangerous because it seems like there's no strong voice pushing back against it. Certainly within the establishment, there's nobody pushing back. Nobody wants to be seen for obvious reasons as a defender of Vladimir Putin. It's not like, I mean, the Soviets at least stood for equality, equality of incomes, gender equality, and different things like that, at least on paper. You know, what does the Kremlin stand for? This is not it's a conservative, very conservative, neoliberal, conservative regime. So I don't think there's any pushback, and I think it's unleashing a lot of really crazy forces in this country. You know, revanchist cold warriors who never went away. I've seen that all my time out in Russia and since coming back, that those memories are still strong and those people are there and there's a lot of money at stake. I personally don't think at all that it's a coincidence that quite literally the same month that Hagel, former defense secretary, announced some of the largest defense cuts, you know, since the end of World War II, suddenly we have too much going on in Ukraine and all those cuts are canceled and looks like budgets are going to be increased and Hagel is out and so on and so forth. Russia's kind of the perfect enemy so long as he's the perfect enemy for the defense establishment. It means large budgets and large weapons procurements and large bureaucracies and an enemy we're familiar with who makes, it makes a good narrative, and this is the kind of thing these people like. But we got lucky in the Cold War that everything didn't blow up, and we've learned since the end of the Cold War that we came close several times. And I just, you know, I don't want to put all my faith in luck.
Yeah. Well put, Mark. Mark Ames is our guest here this evening, a founding editor of the satirical Moscow Biweekly, The Exile, author of Going Postal. And we're happy to have you here, Mark. Just one last quick question. We're a little over time, but wanted to ask you this, maybe to sort of dig down a little bit in that last observation. Who, in your mind, are the main beneficiaries if the U.S. and Russia reignite a new Cold War?
Well, the defense industry and the military industrial complex, the military intelligence complex, no doubt about it. Like I said, there was a push by Hegel shortly before he was put into retirement to enact major cuts in 2014. Go back and, you know, reread the articles about it. The military was going to be cut down to its smallest size since the end of World War II, or since before World War II. You know, there were going to be serious cuts, and now that's over. And frankly, that helps the Russians too. I mean, I can tell you, the Russian, you know, their pride was very wounded by their experience under Yeltsin. They were very humiliating years. They were essentially colonized and run from outside, and they didn't matter, and they were considered a joke. And there are people in the Kremlin who, I think Putin even said this, they like the fact that we talk about them as if they count and as if they're a menace and a rival. They like mattering, number one. Number two, it's good for their defense industries. But that said, you know, their defense budget, I think in the last 2 years, is in the $65 billion range. Ours is about $600 billion. And because of their economy has been hurting, the budgets for the next 3 years, they're cutting their military 6% per year, according to the published reports. So I think cold warriors on both sides, military industrial complex on both sides, and then neocons in general. They love this. The neocons in Washington absolutely love this. They feel relevant again.
Well, we're about out of time, but just on that observation about the neocons, I just read this the other day that the president of the National Endowment for Democracy, Carl Gershon, a notable neocon, actually has proposed that the United States work hard to overthrow Putin. So,
that's not a good sign.
Mark,
no, it's not a good sign. That's crazy. And you know, he had once bragged that the NED does what the CIA used to do more clandestinely. So I take it seriously. One last thing. I'm sorry to cut you off. I should add, too, that I co-host a podcast called Radio Warnerd. I hope there's time to put that in. But if you could tell listeners, go visit our Patreon page, Radio Warnerd. It's myself and another person from the exile days, known as the Warnerd. And we talk about a lot of this stuff.
Spell that, Warnerd. What is it?
War and nerd.
Nerd. War, nerd. Got it.
Yeah.
All right, Mark. Yeah, I actually listened to it. It's great, and I would definitely recommend
it.
Yeah, it's very cool stuff. Mark, appreciate the time here, and you also write with Pando Daily, right?
Yeah, I haven't been doing too much writing this year. Just had my kid, but I do write with Pando Daily, and I'll be back in the text writing again, you know, sometime very soon.
All right. Well, I certainly enjoyed this, and you know, a lot of substance there that we need to have more widely disseminated. I hope we can invite you back soon. Thanks.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate
it. Take care, Mark. Bye bye.
You too. Bye.
That's Mark Ames, founding editor of the satirical Moscow Biweekly, The Exile, and one of the co-hosts of the War Nerd podcast on Patreon, and also writes with the Pando Daily online publication.